All right, Process listeners, we're back for another Sensation Spectacular, and to be honest, I don't even know what number it is, but I'm sure it's going to be one of our best. With me today is Mark Andrew Smith, who is a guy with a list of credits. You'd think he was an old dude in the industry. The man's done all sorts of work. We've got editing work on the Pop Gun anthologies for Image Comics, a lot of people's favorite young adult comic over the past year with Gladstone School for World Conquerors, and he's got a slew of other things that he's done. Really stoked to have you with us today. Mark, how are you going?
Hey, Ryan. Thanks for having me. I'm well. They played against the pros. So this baseball team goes to this town, but the town has a curse on it, and after the sun goes down, in the seventh inning, the people and the townsfolks and the other team all turn into these flesh-eating monsters, you know, with a huge appetite for destruction. So it's baseball players using all their skills, just beating the hell out of monsters with baseball bats and, you know, giving secret signals, fastball pitches. It's just complete splatter horror fun.
I'd read somewhere when you're selling this book and you're talking about them, you know, using their baseball skills, it sounds like too much fun. Is it an all-ages thing, or is it really, does it delve into the horror?
It delves into the horror. It's not an all-ages thing, so I'm usually an all-ages writer, but for this, it's just completely fun, and there's blood and guts, and do not let your kids pick up this book until they're, you know, well over 13.
Because that's the thing, like, I know you've written a lot of sort of all-ages stuff, and you're really good at it, and the high concept for this does sound a little bit all-ages, and I do worry that some little girl's going to pick it up in the store and start crying. So, and maybe that's testament to how good the good the story is, that's for sure.
Know, maybe you always hear, like, some parents outraged, you know, they want the book, the library to burn this book, so, I don't know, maybe if that happens, it'd be good publicity.
Oh, yeah, you can't get any better publicity than the libraries across America banning your book, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, I got to know, man, baseball and horror, where do you start to mash those two up?
Ever since I was a little kid, I, you know, really loved baseball. And my family are big San Francisco Giants fans, like, it's spanning, like, generations. So, you know, I've always loved baseball, and I've watched every, like, baseball movie from, like, the really old ones, like the Lou Gehrig story, you know, the Babe Ruth story, and the Sandlot, Major League, League of Their Own, just all kinds, and Field of Dreams. But I love baseball, and then I also love horror. Like, I'm a huge fan of Sam Raimi's Evil Dead series, Army of Darkness, Peter Jackson's Dead Alive. So, I don't know, at some point, and I think it was like in 2004, that idea came to me of just this team of baseball players, like, fending off this, you know, back of bat with baseball bats, kind of like the baseball Furies and the Warriors, just going to town on these monsters. And then, you know, I started to develop the roster and, like, flesh out the idea more and more. And it just grew and grew and grew into this 200-page book.
Now, it's interesting that it's so big. How did this thing, I mean, it's a graphic novel, so Why is it so large? 200 pages is quite a hefty tome. Is it just that big a story?
It started off as a 70-pager, but what happened when James Stokoe came on is I would get pages in from him, and then I would just get kind of carried away with it. And those pages, I saw them, and they just pumped me up and motivated me. So as I was writing the next sections of the book, it just grew and grew and grew, and it, you know, came up with bigger and bigger stuff. But I think in total the story pages is probably about maybe 185 pages, and then the rest of the contents pinups and things like that.
Now, you've mentioned the artist there, James Stokoe. He's become pretty big name, I would say, now with his series from Image Orcstein. There's a lot of people that are really enjoying his work at the moment, and I would say having him on the book as well with you has got to help with sales. How did you initially get him onto the project?
I've known about James Stokoe since 2004, when I first saw his World War G pages online, which was the Godzilla fan comic that he did. And I emailed him and asked him to do a pinup for the first book I did, Amazing Glory Brothers. And he did a pinup, and then, you know, just kept talking to him. And I was editing the Pop Gun anthology and trying to bring the best talents that I knew about that wanted to give, like, a wider audience to. So he actually did the first Orkstein story was in Pop Gun. And I think from there, you know, after I had Sullivan's more ready to go, then, you know, I sent it to him and, you know, he came on it and agreed to work on the book with me.
That's pretty good, because at the moment as it stands, you've got you and you've got James, and you're certainly going to want to sell this book. Everybody wants to sell their book, but you're going a different route with selling this book, and I find it really intriguing that you're taking this book to Kickstarter instead of just sending it through, I guess, the usual pipelines where I'm used to seeing your work. Let's talk Kickstarter. When did you first start realizing you were going to make this a crowdfunded adventure?
I think it was just a few months ago, just to wrap it up, because usually I'll do books, but they just break even. And, you know, I really have been seeing these Kickstarters do really well, and it's been inspiring. So I really want to, you know, establish a direct contact with the audience and the readership to build my base. And then, you know, also just cut out a lot of the middlemen and just sell contact more direct. Because I do comics, but it doesn't really like benefit me in any way. You know, it's just kind of a favor, I guess. But I don't monetize on it. So I think with Kickstarter, it actually does help, you know, fund things and then, you know, reward creators for the work that they do. So hopefully it'll go well, and I'll be able to speed up, you know, across the board on all projects and do it as more of a full-time thing.
When is your campaign going to launch?
It should launch, I think, Tuesday of next week on, what day is that? I think it's the 16th.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's nerve-wracking to do Kickstarter and to take the chance, but, you know, I think it'll pay off overall.
It's, and how, to get into nuts and bolts just shortly with the audience to be able to hear, how much money are you hoping to raise?
The short goal is $6,000, because a lot of friends told me, okay, just start small so that you know, reach that goal in a day or two, and then people like to back a winner once they've seen that. So the first goal is $6,000, and, you know, I'm not really sure. I think if I say something and it doesn't reach it, you know,
that's right.
I don't know.
It's really interesting trying to set those goals on Kickstarter, because if you set them too high, you may sort of never get there. And if you set them too low, you get there so quick and, I don't know, it can sort of peter out. And you've got to find that realistic benchmark of what is it worth, but what is it worth to you and what is it worth to the audience? And, I mean, that's always a tricky line to find
this
in.
This week I've seen a lot of books doing, like, 50K and 60K. So, you know, if I did something like that, that would just be life-changing for me. In fact, you know, as far as being able to do things more full-time and financing. So I think secretly I'm hoping for 50K. But if I make 20K, you know, I'll be happy with that.
And so through the campaign, people will be able to order the book. Is it hardcover?
It's a hardcover.
And how much do they have to pledge in order to get it?
The book is $30, and then there's also T-shirts on there as well. But for anyone where that's expensive, there's also a $10 PDF of the book that they can download and read on the computer.
So a $10 PDF version, $30 to get. Is it 200 pages of your writing and James Ducot's art? I don't know, that seems like a pretty good deal, man. I think I could see that going well, to be honest.
It's pretty massive and epic, and it is James Ducot, you know, so I think it is a very good deal, and it helps us to recoup faster. So, you know, they are buying a book, but it is helping out the creators a lot.
Now, I need to wonder, because you've done a lot of work, and most of it through Image, with Sullivan Sluggers. Had you shopped that around at all, or... I mean, I want to get inside baseball a little bit, but I don't want you to have to annoy anybody.
No, I shopped around to Image, and they picked it up. So, but, I mean, it's been, like, I think 2 years since it was supposed to come out. So I'm doing the hardcover on Kickstarter, and then there still might be the potential to publish it through comic shops and maybe single issues or trade paperback. But I think... I'm focusing on the Kickstarter first and foremost to sell as many hardcover copies as I can, and then I might they kind of pace it out between a year or two for the other things to come out.
How are Image with that? I mean, do you then have to discuss with them that you're doing a Kickstarter?
I told them about it, and I think they should be okay with it. Hopefully they're not upset, you know, about me doing the Kickstarter, because it is a hardcover, and you know, it's not the trade paperback, and they still have the option to do that. So
if it launches and gets shut down in like 3 days and the feds swarm it, we'll know that Image didn't appreciate it.
No, I don't think anything like that will happen. Image is great, and you know, I love them as a publisher, and they do good books, but I just really want
to... They seem really flexible. I've noticed they're letting people put their books up on Keenspot. It's been really impressive the way that they do business.
Yeah, I think they're flexible enough and easygoing, and they're not out to like kill me or anything or put a hit on me. And you know, they do publish great books, and they're great at what they do. So I think even with Kickstarter, there is room for publishers and you know, retailers to be involved. It doesn't mean you know, the growth of Kickstarter doesn't mean the detriment of anyone, or that the comics and comic shops will be like lessened in any way. It's just growing and expanding the pool and the audience of comic books, so it's better than everyone, better for everyone. But I think that the publishers have a place in Kickstarter, because Image puts out great, slick, beautiful product all the time. So I could see in the future that creators would publish through Kickstarter, you know, get the orders in, and then, you know, go through Image, because they put out a great product to publish and produce it.
Yeah, absolutely. It should have a place in sort of what we're doing.
Yeah, I think right now people are kind of cautious or worried about, you know, firstly like digital and then other things. But I think if they just embrace it, I think everyone will benefit from it.
We had a big discussion about Kickstarter on our show, I think a few weeks back. And it is. It's really interesting to see different people's viewpoints of how they view Kickstarter. And some people, I know some people get a little annoyed that they feel it can be double dipping sometimes. And some people feel that if it went to Kickstarter, maybe it wasn't good enough to go elsewhere. Personally, I love Kickstarter. I think the things that you can find on there, and it's basically just a pre-ordering method. That's the way I look at it.
I think there is kind of like the false idea that things that go on Kickstarter are things that got pitched that weren't good enough to be printed, but I think more and more, you know, as people see more and more success from it, it's becoming the first choice for creators to go to for original content. And maybe I think we'll see content there that hasn't been pitched before anywhere else, or that'll start coming there that was already established. And eventually, like the wall of the dam's going to crack, and there'll be a big, you know, flood and influx of things.
Yeah, and then they talk about there being a Kickstarter bubble that may burst, and it's just this wild landscape, and it's really interesting to see. Some people believe you shouldn't run more than one campaign. It's to kickstart you, and other people think that when you start, you should be backing yourself with your own money. It's really amazing to see the different ways that people can view Kickstarter, and overall, I think mostly it's getting product into people's hands, and if you want it, you pledge your money and you go and get it, and that's how any sort of commerce works. If you want it, you go and get it.
It's a market. I mean, you can sell the readers directly, and it's a pre-ordering system. You know how many to print, and it helps finance everything. But yeah, I don't think you should be limited to one Kickstarter. I mean, people have many different ideas, and you know, Kickstarter one time, they're just imposing these kind of neurotic rules on themselves. Or you know, it's kind of it's hard to explain that. I can't understand it.
Yeah, it becomes very arbitrary at points, I've found, where, I mean, I try to back things that I like, and if the price is right and the product is what I want, I'll go out and I'll make sure that I'm helping make it happen. And not only do I then get a copy of whatever it may be. I mean, there's the graphic textbook that's on there at the moment.
Oh, yeah, I back that.
Yeah, I think I saw it initially because you tweeted it, I think. And I really want to see that succeed, and I've put in money.
Ben Caldwell cover, and it's got 9 days, and it's so close. So I wanted to push it too.
Yeah, I want a copy of that book. I want to be able to teach that in my classroom, sort of thing. Like, I put my money down because I thought it was it's a good cause, but I'm also getting something for it. And if you start throwing money towards these things and you've got to spend $100 to get the single issue, I think that's garbage, and pricing is really important. And looking at the way you've priced Sullivan Sluggers, I think it works really well. $30 for a 200-page hardcover is phenomenal. And especially with the level of creative talent that's on board, I'm really supportive of this. And once it launches, I'm really keen to sort of chart it. And I like that a lot of creators are watching other creators and going, oh, okay, you've tried it.
Yeah, they integrated the follow function in there in the past month, and that's been pretty cool because you get to see what your friends are backing. And it is like, you know, you kind of do want to impress and be helpful or be seen a little bit. Also because it's generated kind of this community element to it. But I think
it's magnanimous.
This next year, I think I do want to just take, you know, the $300 that I would, like, spend on comics in a year and just, you know, allot that to the supporting Kickstarter projects, because that's more interesting, and there's a lot more interesting projects coming through there that, you know, are complete surprises out of left field that are, you know, deserving of support. So I think this year that'll be my goal, to, you know, support a lot of projects and just set a budget for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think actually I got an email the other day that showed you'd backed the short story of the month club, I think it was called.
Oh, Dave Hopkins, who was in Top Gun. Yeah, I like Dave, and you know, I've known him for a while, so I saw that he was doing it. It's like, okay, you know, I think part of the appeal with that is he's been a teacher for 9 years for English, and you know, he wants to do it as a job. So I could relate to that, and that's why I backed it.
Because I probably wouldn't have found that campaign except for the fact that, you know, I'm following you on Kickstarter, and then that comes into my email, and then I opened that campaign up and said, yep,
I think that's cool, and I back it as well. I mean, as a creator, you build your fan base, and you can promote yourself just like a few times a year when you have something out, but you might as well like lend that fan base and, you know, help other people, because it'll be your turn eventually to get helped.
Exactly, and I find like, I don't go on Kickstarter every day, and I'm not checking out. And there's so many campaigns that are constantly launching. It's hard to find out what's on there. And a big thing that I rely on is Twitter. I hope that people plug different, not just their own, but different Kickstarter or Indiegogo projects that they want to see get up, because that's about the only way I'm going to hear about it. Maybe once a month I'll go on there and I'll troll through Kickstarter and just see what's about. But otherwise, I don't really have time to do that. And so it's really good that this social media, people are putting it forward.
I like it too, and then, I mean, if you see a project but you can't back it, I mean, you can at least, you know, tweet or like it on Facebook, and that, you know, like spreads the blast zone of the project a lot more.
Yeah, it's all support, and it all sort of, it builds towards them hopefully eventually meeting their goal, which is exactly what you sort of want. That's definitely what they want, whoever is running the campaign. So I'm hoping once yours starts, I think it'll get a lot of sort of love on Twitter and Facebook, and hopefully a few news sites will pick up the news and run with it. And I mean, getting you on the podcast here, I think, was a fantastic idea. You've got to hit every sort of avenue that you possibly can to get the news out there. But I mean, are you doing a 60-day campaign?
No, it's for 30 days, because they said if you do 60 days, then there's no urgency to it. So better to do 30.
There's all sorts of stats there where it's like 30-day campaigns do better than this, and it's a really crazy math game.
Yeah,
I love it.
It's a complete math game. It's really interesting, and there's so many like things to factor in. And they said if you end on a weekend, you know, it's not as good, so end on a weekday. There's, I mean, people, it'll probably be like, you know, there'll probably be thesis papers for doctorates like written about it.
Oh man, it's like Moneyball. It's absolutely crazy, and there's all these little sort of nuanced rules. It cracks me up absolutely. Like I think it was at the end of last year, I set up we had to do Indiegogo because Kickstarter is America only, obviously, and we're Australian. And so me and a few mates were putting this anthology together, and we did it through Indiegogo. And one of the girls in our group, she did all the research, and she was like, "All right, if we run for this long, we've got the best chance. If we get a donation within the first day, we've got a better chance of getting up." And there's all these different random little rules that sort of help your statistics to go through to see success. And I mean, in the end, we wanted $2,000 and we got I think 4.25, so it was really cool to get that success. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, it went really well. Now we had an initial print run of, I think, about 250, and we've got about 11 left. So it was really good that we had stacks of pre-orders through Indiegogo, and now we've been selling them through a few comic shops here. We went to a con, and now we're almost out. So that's
I think that's nice. After Kickstarter, there's also the potential to have inventory and have a web shop and, you know, keep promoting. And
yeah,
there's actually sites in the U.S. now that they house it, and they charge $10 a month, and they ship for you, and it's like,
oh wow,
charge a 15% fee. So I mean, all the pieces of commerce are like falling in for the infrastructure more gradually, and just setting up like this perfect template to just have a go of it on your own, and, you know, just like do like less middleman, but just have it be more automated and easier to do.
That's insane. People will never have to leave their houses again.
It's great. And I mean, you can order a book at a shop or order a book on Amazon. It gets there in a day or two through the post. And then, you know, the price is the same for, I think, retailers. And after Diamond, you know, you get like maybe one third of the book. But here, you know, you just have costs and shipping, and, you know, everything else goes to you. So I think you can sell less and make more, and it's definitely getting a lot more attractive.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. So you're hoping to certainly exceed expectations with Sullivan Sluggers and maybe have a little bit of profit come out of it, I guess.
Yeah, I hope so. Hope for the best.
Well, that's exactly it, and I'm sure everyone will do their best to sort of push it forward. It's a really exciting project, and I mean, it's something that you've been working on for so long. I mean, we're talking, it wasn't like you wrote it this year.
No, it dates back to 2004, in fact.
That is a long, long time ago. What's it like to have it drawn out so much?
I mean, I wish I could say it was a joy, but it's the opposite of a joy. I think the initial idea came in 2004, and then it got kind of shoved into a drawer for later, and then plucked up in about 2009 when I, you know, started seriously working on it. And then through the project getting like larger and larger, and James getting more like paid or, you know, work or stuff that was due like work stain. You know, it was tedious to get everything turned in and finally have it. But I mean, now that it is, it's a very good feeling. And I think I definitely appreciate the book so much after, you know, so much went into making it, so much time.
I'd be really worried with writing it over, what's that equal? It's about 8 years. I would be worried I would be tinkering with it too much and breaking it apart. Is it very similar to what you sort of started off with?
I think it's a lot better because it's grown and gestated, and then, you know, I think time would go by and I'd just revisit everything and look at it with fresh eyes and a fresh perspective and just be in different places and, you know, travel and see the world, and, you know, just the viewpoint would change a little bit. So I think it's been really healthy for it, actually.
That's pretty cool. And it sounds like this crazy, like a Joe R. Lansdale type story where it's a very, very kooky high concept. And having seen some of the art, it's really atmospheric. And it comes across like this really, really warped sort of 80s horror flick, and you almost feel like Bruce Campbell. Does Bruce Campbell get a walk on somewhere?
He should. I love Bruce Campbell. He was like a god to me when I was a little kid.
He is certainly an interesting actor. He's done some good stuff, and I could see him playing a crazy, like, aged baseball captain fighting against this demonic town.
I think that's kind of who I was channeling when I was thinking of Sullivan, the main character.
Yeah. I think it's a really cool project, man, and I'm really, really hoping to watch this thing blow up on Kickstarter, and it should go fantastically well. I know we will do our best to certainly push it forward. Now, I wanted to get into a bit more sort of a process chat with you as well.
Yeah.
I'm really interested when I talk to other writers. I mean, those that are able to just write full time, and I know you hold down a day job,
yeah,
and you're an ESL teacher. And yet you're still pumping out a fair bit of products. How do you find sort of the life balance is with daytime job and trying to do comic writing around that?
Well, I started off in Asia and Korea writing, and my schedule was really good. And started work at 4 p.m. and then ended it at 10 p.m. So I'd have one morning to go and write. So I think during solo events, I was actually working on it in Korea and then Taiwan, and then now I'm in Thailand teaching ESL. But I mean, it's been good, but also with, like, right now I'm working just a pretty hectic schedule, but it's, the more hectic it gets, the more I write, because, you know, I'll just print stuff out, and it's like, oh, you can't write, you don't have time to write. So whenever I hear that voice, I just fight it, and I'll print out stuff and work on stuff in the minutes between breaks and keep notebooks and jot things down. So it's actually very motivating, I think.
Are you a real time? You mentioned they're working from like 4 to 10. So do you set sort of specific timetables and just go out, this is work time?
Before, when I had that schedule, I would just wake up and get a nice French press and make some Starbucks and, you know, just have like 4 cups of coffee and get wound up and just go to it and put on music and it was great. But now I'm working at, like, I wake up at like 6 a.m. and then, you know, work till 4, and when I get off, it's pretty difficult. So at school, between breaks, you know, on breaks and things like that, I'll do a lot of writing.
That's really good. I mean, that's certainly commitment, man, to just sort of say, like, so in between classes, you're just, I mean, are you able to, does it affect the flow of how you work? Are you just sort of jotting down more sketchy sort of stuff, or do you just sort of open up to the next page of script that you're writing and just sort of hack away at a panel?
So the way I write is everything begins in like notebooks with sketches, notes, and doodles and things like that, and I can't really write directly on the computer, so I'll do a huge like brainstorm word bubble like you do when you write an essay, just jotting down like the main influences and ideas and lines of dialogues and things like that. And then I can't work on the computer, so I have to print, go to a coffee shop, I just scribble all over those notes and you know, add more things in. Go home, type that up, and do some little bit of writing on that, the actual computer, and then repeat that about like 10 times until, you know, keep going back to it, editing, adding more, like a coffee shop or wherever I happen to be with the printed copy, and, you know, revising it on the computer document. So that's usually how I work. And, you know, sometimes 2 weeks will go by, you know, since I looked at something. That's actually really helpful because you do have the fresh eyes.
What's the aversion to working on the computer? I'm interested.
I don't know exactly.
Just doesn't gel well with you?
I don't know. It doesn't gel well, or it's not comfortable. I like just being in new surroundings, or, you know, just having paper to write on when like generating writing. Sometimes like I can do it, but it's just the preferred method, I think. And also exercise is important for writing, because I think with Gladstone's for World Conquerors, a lot of that book wasn't written, it was written in the swimming pool when I was doing laps, and just had, you know, like free time just to think, and was in almost a meditative state. There's a lot of things in the process that are pretty beneficial, and I guess that's how I do it, you know.
So if you're swimming laps and you're thinking about Gladstone's, does that mean, like, as soon as you're finished, are you, like, running out of the pool to get some pen and paper and make sure you're not losing it?
Yeah, exactly. I think in Taiwan, I had a motorbike and, you know, I'd run to 7-Eleven, buy a notepad, and just get the ideas down as fast as I could, and then type it up and go to coffee shops. And I think I wrote the end of Gladstone's there, and I think that was some of my most favorite writing that I did was the end of that with the big fight, and I would just keep coming back to it and like upping the stakes. So, yeah.
That's pretty cool. I got to agree, like that I find the note taking, I like it to be a bit more tactile, and I like being able to sort of write things and scratch them out again, and I use a lot of notepaper there, but then once I've sort of planned it, I always find that the computer is where I'll do sort of the scripting of it.
And another thing I do is, I think most of the dialogue, I'll do different drafts or takes of the dialogue, and then the final stages for the lettering script, I just gut all the panel descriptions and just leave the dialogue, and then finally settle on the version that I want of the dialogue. But I think a lot of people approach it like dialogue first, because they've seen you know, a lot of movies or go the screenwriting perspective of that.
Yeah.
But I find just having different variables and takes and things like that actually helps. But it could kind of be maddening at the same time. There's, okay, which one do I pick of that?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I find it interesting, you work in public. You're one of the writers that goes to coffee shops. It's we've had that discussion on the pod where, like, Kurt and I generally stay at home to write, but Jeremy is very much a dude who just wants to sort of get out of the house, be somewhere else. And I always think, if I was sitting in a coffee shop working, I don't know how I wouldn't be distracted. There's so many things happening and people. I love people watching. It's fascinating as hell.
Yeah,
and that would put me off. But I mean, it could also
I think there's room for it because you have that noise, and you can just take a break and, you know, read a book. And reading is also very important to writing, and just just look around, listen to conversations and things like that. So I don't know, I think that the noise and everything, it does help. I've never been one to bring my laptop, you know, and just pose like I'm writing, you know. But
yeah.
It's always just printed paper I'm working on, and I'll bring a few printed things and a notebook and just start scribbling as much as I can. And it's almost meditative because, you know, you kind of sit there looking at the page and you just start writing whatever pops into your head.
Do you find with all that printing out in notepads, you've just got this copious amount of paper? And if so, how do you sort of keep track of it all?
I type up everything off the notepads like really quickly, just so I don't misplace any of it, and get it on the computer and then just keep printing off. But I think I fill up a notebook once every month. Like, I'll go through an entire notebook, which is
nice. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's other stuff too. Like, you know, like what I'm supposed to do for the week, and then also spray ideas and things like that.
Do you find once you've got it all typed up, I mean, do you have to have little sacrificial notebook burnings, or?
I just rip out the pages and throw them away usually. So there's nothing. Yeah, nothing's sacred. I don't think it's going to the Smithsonian.
Oh, man, that's crazy. You mentioned reading is so important to writing. Do you find, depending on the project you're working on, that affects what you're reading, or do you just sort of read whatever you feel like?
I read whatever I feel like, but, you know, sometimes I'll like to read a book about, like, writing and process and things like that, and it'll give me good insight. For projects, and then also like listening to podcasts about, you know, the nuts and bolts of comics and how different people approach things.
I love listening to comic podcasts, and it's one of the reasons I was really keen to start up this show, is because I didn't feel there was something consistently dedicated to what we do, whereas there are some really good comic podcasts out there that will have guests on, and so you'll get, you know, a few fleeting glimpses. But
there's nothing completely dedicated to, like, the craft of things, though. And then a lot of podcasts, they'll do a laundry list of the different books and they came out, and usually they'll throw like the indie stuff at the very end, like 50 minutes into it. And, you know, I really want to hear, like, what inspires people and motivates people, and, you know, how they work and think about approaching things and different characters. And, you know, I think, like, feeding off energy like that, you know, it's definitely inspiring and kind of, you know, grows and it's contagious.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had to sort of instill this new rule with podcasts where if I'm not learning sort of something from your podcast, I can't tune into just sort of chatter anymore.
I think so too, with like Adam Carolla or Joe Rogan. It's just like the Adam Carolla show, he just says like the same thing again, and then the lady kind of laughs at all his jokes, like the Jabba's little like helper minion Muppet guy, you know. And,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can only take so much of that, and then they really do run in just the comfortable circles of what's funny or what they think will get laughs.
Yeah, they play to this sort of simple audience, and it's, I don't know, I want something, like I listen to the Word Balloon comic podcast, and I like that because the creators really open up there, and you always feel like you get something out of listening to those, and so they're the sorts of things I found that I'm looking for. Or a great podcast that I've only just discovered was the Radio Lab one, and
oh,
it's
yeah.
It's phenomenal for getting ideas.
They did a great one about the velocity of cats falling off buildings. And I think it was like a scientific study. These cats in New York would be in like these skyscrapers and get pushed out the window. But like there's a different variable about like if they fell higher, they would live from like the 13th floor up. But if they fell like the five floors are down, they'd be okay. But in between, they would die. But higher up, they'd kind of spread themselves out and reach like this terminal velocity or kind of like balance themselves out. And it's really fascinating. They do a great show.
Yeah, the production value, they put it together, and every episode I've listened to, I always sort of think, oh, I could use that in a story, or you could sort of see there was one in a recent one, and I know I'm going to use this scene in a comic sort of thing, and I was like, that's brilliant, and I had jotted it down in the notebook for that title, and I was just like, there you go, it's one little thing, and I've just sort of taken it, and I've repurposed it a little bit, and I thought, that's genius, like, that's where you need to be finding these things. And yeah, I mean I'm a big Kevin Smith fan, and I've listened to a lot of his podcasts, but I just can't do it anymore because it's the same stuff.
Yeah, it's a lot of flashlight jokes and things like that.
Man.
Most of them are. I think that's the litmus test, is there's like a flashlight joke, just turn it off right away.
That's why we want to make one. The
Moss podcast, that one's really good.
I haven't, but I've had a mate who's constantly telling me that I need to listen to that, and I keep meaning to sort of add it into the feed.
It's fantastic. There's just people on stage telling true stories that happened to them, and you know they do a great job. It's really compelling.
Are you the sort of guy that just will like tell those sort of almost campfire stories that'll sort of get the audience hooked in?
I think a few years ago I went through like kind of a hard time. So I was that guy for like a little while because I did have those stories, and I've been around and I've seen some stuff, you know.
So, <Yeah. laughs>
I have a lot of great stories like that that, you know, might be appropriate or not be appropriate, that are just hilarious and out of this world. But, you know, it just depends on who I'm around as far as if I can tell those stories or not.
Whether you can get away with it, that's for sure. I was at a party one time, and I told this story, and it went for about, it must have been about 40 minutes. And someone came up to me and was just like, is this story going to end, dude? And I looked at him, and I was just like, when these people stop standing there and listening and loving it and laughing in the right spots, I'll shut my mouth. Like,
yeah,
otherwise, it's a good story. It was going forward. It was about me and a mate that went cotton chipping, which... It's where you basically go out to the cotton farms and you're just tearing up all the weeds out of the rows. And you'd think it's a boring setting, but dear Lord, there was some interest. It was way out west, way in the center of Australia, and there were some really interesting people, and you just sort of, I don't know, I soak that stuff up. I absolutely love sort of taking those stories from...
Just last week I was in the country of Thailand, in Isan, and... you know, hanging out on a farm with like a hole in the ground for a toilet, and like giant like lizards just kind of chirping like birds, and I don't know, like all this. We went like fishing for fish and did all this stuff. There's chickens running around. It's like you know, it's like when you see the like Rambo going to the village. It was that.
Place. Yeah.
You know, so I've done stuff like that a lot, but you know, it's kind of it's just gotten more and more usual, I think. But there's something to be said for being able to tell a good story. And I mean, like, the World War II generations or grandfathers are able to do that stuff really well, but it's kind of lost on the new generation because they just talk on the computer and, you know...
It's 140 characters or less now. Yeah. The story's going to be succinct.
Yeah, you got to make a tweet. You know, it's like people are pissed off at you for wasting their time, you know, or they can go home and be alone on their computer.
Yeah, it's something that people don't seem to be glomming onto anymore, which is a real shame. I'd love nothing better than just sort of like having a chat and soaking up that sort of vibe of what you see and then repurposing it. And I don't know, I like to put that into my writing at times where I'll find something and just go, all right, how can I then repurpose it? Like my wife found out years ago that tiger sharks. The embryos fight it out in the womb, and only one will survive.
Oh,
it's the one that was born.
Oh,
I was like, that is insanely
like
awesome.
Will be vaporous or something like that.
Yeah,
that's a pretty crazy fact to live. You have to kill your brothers and siblings in a while.
Yeah, and I was like, that's really cool. Could I repurpose that so that if I had an alien in a story, perhaps, that was its origin? And you're just like, boom, that'd be awesome. Like, it's something that's within the realm of possible, and you just sort of tweak it a little bit, and you've got a really good sort of, yeah, I believe, and I'm teaching a creative writing sort of workshop at school at the moment in lunchtimes, and the big thing I'm saying to people is it interesting? And if not, make it more interesting. And it's just about looking at something. And I've got this comic that I bought, that's probably a good year ago now. It was an old Dazzler issue, and on it, it's got Dazzler, and it's the little byline says, "Enter Galactus," and you can see Galactus in the background. And I'm like, that's awesome. Like, I want to put more Galactus in my Dazzler, which sounds rude, but it gets my point across that you want every little thing in your story. You're like, all right, how can I make this bigger or bolder? And you mentioned it with Sullivan Sluggers. You've just gone through and tweaked it and just made every little thing pop. And I think that's what you've got to do with your stories, and you'll take aspects from real life, I guess, and you'll just completely fabricate others, but you need to be constantly looking at how can I make this just bolder so it's interesting.
Like one-upmanship, with other things, and yeah, also like yourself as well. Especially with like Gladstone, like I kind of started small and, started just establishing the world, and then once it got picked up, the story picked up and it was like ready to go. Like, as far as like the attacks and moves and things, like, okay, I can't repeat attack. I gotta come up with something like really cool for this character. And, I think it's always like that. And if you can push and motivate yourself to beat what you've done before and beat yourself, before what you've done, and, outdo everything you've done before, I think that's a great attitude to bring to the table. And it's like Dazzler. That's really cool.
It's and Gladstone's, man, that was one of those books where it just felt really inventive and it felt fresh and it just felt perfect for kids. It's the sort of thing where it was just like you couldn't turn a page without some sort of awesome concept being presented. And
yeah, it didn't save anything or like hold anything back with it. So I think that's part of the appeal, because a lot of people are like, so many ideas, but I'll save this for another story. But with that, it wasn't the case. It was just push everything forward and make the best book you can.
And that book's gone on hiatus a little bit. It just sort of, there was no announcement or anything. So what's future news for Gladstone's, man?
We're working on the next two volumes simultaneously right now. So Matthew Weldon is the guest artist who did New Brighton Archaeological Society, and he just wrapped book two of New Brighton. So now he's finishing Gladstone's, and we just have to get colored and lettered and everything. And then I wrote series three with Armand Villiers, working on that right now. So hopefully, Weldon will buy Villiers enough time, so the two will come out like pretty close to each other. But I'm thinking right now we'll probably do about six issues a year and kind of keep it in the DBRP format, where we just start, a series heading, a new title for the series, and then like a new number one for four or six issues each time, and then keep doing that. But there's no shortage of Gladstone stories that I have to tell, so I think we can keep at it for a while. But at the same time, I know like the temporary conclusion for it.
Yeah, it seemed to do pretty well critically and with sales, didn't it?
It did pretty well with sales, and I think before I was just so pro original graphic novel, and I was kind of like indie hipster snob for a while, and I was like, this isn't pure, it's not an original graphic novel, that's the future. But you would do so much work and then put it out, and it would just be a blip on the radar for like a month and then just disappear. So there's definitely something rewarding about doing the monthly in a comic shop, and I got so much like positive response and feedback from doing that. So I think it has been a hit, just been like resonated and connected with people.
Are you pretty committed to doing more of the monthly gig then?
I like the monthly, and I like being in shops also. So yeah, I'd like to do more monthly, but at the same time, I don't want to just be working like mindlessly just to be on the treadmill and keeping things out. So take a little break to just keep the quality high and keep it interesting for me is really beneficial.
And I mean, and to take a step back then to go, way back when. I mean, was Pop Gun the first thing you did with Image?
No, the very first one was The Amazing Joy Buzzards, and it's...
That was before it, yeah.
It's a rock and roll band, and they travel around with a Mexican genie luchador and solve mysteries. But they work for the CIA and go on tour, but they don't know about it. And that was a really fun book. And then the next one I did was Kill All Parents, which was a one-shot, and then and then Pop Gun... after that, and that Pop Gun was just a beast to edit. It was, you know, each one was like 500 pages, and then, you know, wrangling people and getting everything.
How did you get the gig on Pop Gun? How did that come about?
I inherited another anthology that was like a smaller one, and so I was going to take that over for the second volume, but then I got talking to my friend Joe Keating, and he just said, you know, I just gave all these ideas for different people to invite, and, you know, it's his idea, like, okay, this is big, let's just change the name and do something, like, brand new and start from scratch. So, you know, him and I, we built that from the ground up, and then our editor, DJ Kirkbride, came on, who's been really beneficial in terms of, like, helping us out with that. And, I mean, yeah, I think we exposed, like, so many different talents that have gone on to do, pretty huge thing. I'd like to see just somebody keep score at some point and just go through and tick the boxes.
The amount of people that use that as a launching pad and that are sticking around now, that's for sure. It's those things are absolutely mammoth in the industry, and I mean, you guys swept some awards with them, and it was really, really massive.
Yeah, we got the Eisner and the Harvey, and then Volume 4 the Kirkbride edited. I got the Harvey last year too, so I mean, that's a good feeling to get the recognition for those.
And you mentioned you did it with Joe Keating. I only found out the other day I have the exact same birthday as Joe Keating, date and year.
I feel bad. I don't know Joe's birthday. I bet he doesn't know mine.
I'm sure not. It just made me really sad to realize that he's the exact same age as me, and he's done so much. Makes me feel like I've wasted my life.
Joe's younger, actually. I think he's...
Because he'll be 30 in June.
Really? I thought he was 27 for some reason, but it might have been just the last time. I think time is going by in the blink of an eye, and I'm just getting old fast.
You'll lose years like nothing else.
I think
sure.
2 months till 33, and it feels like just yesterday, you know. Like working.
I would say for a 33-year-old, though, you've got a lot of work under your belt. That's pretty impressive.
I think I'm just stubborn, maybe. the key to it all.
I'm interested with Amazing Joy Buzzards, then. If that was your entry into Image, was that something that you pitched at a con? Or, I mean, the slush pile at Image is pretty notorious for never actually yielding anything coming through. How did you get that into Image?
With Amazing Joy Buzzards, I was working on the idea after I graduated from university, and... you know, I wrote down the idea, and then one time I went to Comic-Con in 2002, before, like, the internet was huge for networking, and I just chased down people with portfolios and asked them to look at their portfolios, you know, and got their cards, and just, you know, was confident and networked, and one of the people I met there was Dan Hipp, the illustrator for that, and I think I was the first person to know about him. So I made this list of everybody that I met, looked at their portfolio, and put notes and ranked them. And at the top of the list, my favorite was Dan Hipp, and he happened to live close by, so I called him and went to his house and talked to him about working on a project. But the project was actually a different project. It was a screenplay that I wrote in school called Victorian Space Tales. It was like Millais' trip to the moon, with like these producer characters with no morals and that were like awful people. And then I asked if he could do, you know, drawings for Joy Buzzards, and the publishers were more interested in Joy Buzzards. So at the time, Eric Larson had just taken over as the publisher, and I got in under that tenure. I think Jim Mahfood and Scott Morris helped out like a little bit to make the connection. And I was just so elated when we got the news and, you know, holding the first copy of my book ever. I was on cloud nine. But you know, I didn't realize that it would take like years and years, and 10 years later, I'm still kind of doing the same thing. I feel like I'm in the same spot, but with a lot more books out and in print, you know, more awards. But I don't know if that. Well, no, I think things have changed like quite a bit. I can't be that self-deprecating. But
I was gonna say, yeah, that's That's a crazy way to look at it. You're like, oh, I know I've got all these Eisners and, you know, all these books under my belt, but I'm still just the same young whippersnapper pitching away at Image.
I don't have Mike McDonald's mansion yet, you know, or City of movie theaters. So I think there is a lot of, like, you know, you just compare yourself to other people. But, you know, that can be rough.
You'd be able to get most books through at Image now. You seem to have a very good working relationship with them.
Yeah, they're really good, and usually I can just do what I like there. So I like that.
Have you looked into sort of branching out into working for the big two? Is that something that interests you at all?
I don't know. It's really, there's a lot of rules and like networking, and there's, you know, it really is like a close-knit club, and, you know, if you're like an alien or whatever and try to get in there, they'll eat you. So it's kind of scary. And then I'm not really a pitch guy. You know, I don't like writing pitches and proposals for things that may or may not happen. I like to just, you know, I write my pitch for my book, and I know that this will happen with, you know, like 100% certainty. You know, it's mine and I can do it. But, I mean, if the opportunity presented itself, and just jump at a chance to like Wolverine or Batman or Spider-Man book. I think it'd be fun. But at the same time, that's just the hoops and the hurdles and things like that. I think I just don't have the constitution to go through all of that stuff.
Yeah, it's a really interesting way to look at it. I mean, so many people work and strive for that's their end goal. That's when they'll have made it. And I don't know. I don't think it needs to be that way. I mean, it certainly is good money from what I can tell. And that would be nice to sort of be able to just write instead of having the day job as well. But
yeah,
I don't know, that to be able to put something through Image and you just own it, I think there's a lot of power there.
I'd like to be like the Image Stanley or the independent Stanley, you know, that like makes all these great things that are remembered and, you know, but owns everything and, you know, done it their own way.
Yeah. I think it's really cool to be able to just do your thing. And, I mean, if you've got a good wicket at Image and, you know, you can get things up there, I think it's not a bad way to continue. I mean, is that where you see sort of the next 10 years of your career? You've got Sullivan Sluggers coming up now. You've got some more Gladstones coming over the horizon. What more do you want to push forward in your career for 10 years?
I think I have a lot of ideas and different stories that I want to do. And it's just about, I think, part of it is I kind of do like epic stuff with different volumes. So I think one of my goals is to do more like kind of self-contained stuff that can wrap up and, you know, it's more finite in the future. But, you know, finish all the ones that are, you know, epic and in scope and nature. And then, you know, hopefully I want to turn it into a career and something that I can do, you know, on a full-time basis and just get more work out and, you know, just connect with fans and be a lot bigger, like many people do. But at the same time, it's just been like, you know, I've been promoting it and just doing more and more work to bring in readers and get people interested in it.
That's pretty cool. I'm really interested to see how that sort of pushing things forward in that manner will go.
Yeah, me too. I think it
seems like pretty open at the moment.
It's a good book, New Brighton, so, you know, I want to see it, you know, grow and grow with the audience and get bigger and bigger. Because I think it is, like, on, you know, like, you know, the best level, or it can compete with, like, the stuff that is, like, you know, selling extremely well, that is all ages, like, say, A Bone, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, there's those benchmarks to work
for. Yeah, we just haven't had the breaks, you know, to get the groundwork to stand on, to be able to put it out fast enough and, you know, facilitate that. But, you know, we're going to try for it, and we'll do our best.
Yeah, see how it goes. Well, we should probably wrap it up there, Mark. Thanks heaps for coming on the show, mate. It's a real honour to have you come on and sort of talk about all the different things you've got going and how you've been doing them. I found it really interesting, man.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan, for having me. you know, it was fun to talk about all of you know, the process stuff and get it.
And then fingers crossed, everyone will keep their eyes on the Sullivan Sluggers Kickstarter, and we'll all do our best to push it out there, and hopefully you'll make a bit more money than you had expected. We'll see how it goes, I guess.
Yeah, fingers crossed, right? But I think we'll do well. It is GoPro and me, and you know, I think I'll be up for a month just promoting it and not sleeping.
Yeah, it'll be good. Pretty constantly interviews and emails. It'll be pretty mammoth, but it'll be something to watch. I think a lot of other creators will be looking at this because it's two pretty big names in the image game putting something forward, and I think a lot of people are going to want the content. So we'll wait with bated breath and we'll keep our eyes on it. But thanks again for coming on the show, Matt. I hope you have a good wind up to the big mammoth month of selling Sullivan Sluggers.
All right. Thank you, Ryan. What's that? Bathroom.